Hi, I'm Logan Medish, your host of the High Caliber History Podcast, and my guest on the show today is Danny Michael. He is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum and co-host of their museum's podcast, History Unloaded. Prior to becoming curator, Danny was the associate curator at the museum, and he's been in Cody since 2016. Originally from Western Maryland, he's got a BA in history from Cedarville University and an MA in public history from the University of Louisville. And prior to coming to Cody, he worked at the Fraser History Museum. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to catch up and chat again since we haven't for a while.
Yeah. It's definitely been a little while. Things have been wonky to say the least.
Yeah.
So we were chatting before we came on here. You said stuff starting to gear up and get busy for you guys out there. Your summer season is starting to kick in Cody, I guess.
Yeah. For your listeners that, I don't know, I guess if they haven't looked at a map in a while, Cody is in an out of the way place. Our season at the museum is really like Memorial Day to Labor Day, at least traditionally. Okay. And so of course, last year, we actually were able to keep the museum open, but visitor numbers were way down. But it seems like people are ready to get out and about, and we're seeing lots and lots of folks come out to Wyoming to visit Yellowstone and look at some old guns.
There you go. I can't think of a better way to spend my time.
I can't imagine why. Some people choose to, but I can't. I don't identify with them.
I hear you. So I'm curious to know what came first for you. Was it an interest in history or was it an interest in firearms?
That's a good question. I have terrible memory. My memory back that far is a little foggy, but I'm going to say my interest in history was first. But it's a little bit conflated because it was always military history for me.
Okay.
I grew up, you're on the East Coast and you spent time in Maryland, Virginia, PA. You know where Fort Frederick is, I'm sure.
I do.
And if your listeners do, I grew up almost across the street from Fort Frederick. So we would take like evening outings as a family just to go over, and we like, instead of playing wiffle ball in the yard, we go over there and like play on the park grounds. So having an original or at least rebuilt French and Indian War fort as like, that's where I hang out sometimes. It didn't leave me a lot of options in terms of what my interests would be in the future.
Gotcha. Yeah. If it's right there in your backyard, it's kind of hard not to get absorbed into something like that. Right.
Right. And you know, if you're a kid and you go over and they have like a cannon demonstration, you know, what is cooler than that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, have you ever been to Fort Mackinac in Michigan?
No, I haven't made it up to that one.
Okay. Well, that's Mackinac Island is gorgeous. And they've got the fort there. And I remember as a kid going up there on vacation, and they were doing cannon demonstrations. And I don't know if they still do this. They probably don't, because it's probably considered a liability. But like, they pulled someone out of the crowd to come fire the cannon. And lucky me, I was able to get picked. So, you know, here I was a little kid, and they had me up to pull the lanyard and to fire the cannon. I can't imagine their liability still allows them to do that. But it does make, like you said, for a good impression on a kid when they can see cannons and stuff going off.
I joked with my dad once, because normally when I'm back East, he and I will try to go to a Civil War site, because he really enjoy studying Civil War history. I do as well. So we just, you know, we'll make a day trip of someplace, even if we've been there before. And driving back one time, I was like getting really detailed about the cannons that they had at the battlefield. And he's like, I didn't know you liked cannons so much. I was like, I really do. He's like, but I thought you were into guns. I was like, well, I'm really into cannons. It's just guns are more affordable.
Yeah, you ain't kidding. I've often, because I did reenacting for a number of years, and so you often hear of opportunities for like 12-pounder Napoleons come up and stuff, and you're just like, man, that is not cheap. Do you know how many guns I could buy for what a cannon would cost?
Exactly.
Yep. So you got your BA in history and your master's in public history. Were you working in museums before then, or did going through those programs, is that what spurred your desire to work in a museum?
I would say the desire probably came after my BA in history. I went to college. I think we're pretty close in age, so we were probably in school about the same time. But yeah. I went to college and I was undecided. I was the undeclared, the classic undeclared for a little while.
Okay.
I knew I loved history. I'd always enjoyed history. But as you get all the different advice going into college, it's like, what do you do? Is, you know, do you try and find a career that has good paying jobs or high placement rate or all that kind of question, all those kind of questions. Yeah. Eventually I settled on I really love history. I'm not sure if I can make a career out of it, but that's what we're going to go with. So I got my degree without a real good understanding of what that would turn into down the road. I knew I toyed with the idea of teaching, and the school had a history education program, but I specifically didn't go that track. Ended up, I thought, you know, high school teaching wasn't really where I wanted to be, maybe college. But then I graduated in 2010, which was shortly, you know, that was the recession had hit.
Yeah.
Liberal arts history degrees were not exactly in high demand to begin with. So I ended up just working, whatever I could get. I was unemployed a little while out of college, then found a contracting job, did that for a while, realized that my soul was slowly being squeezed out of me, and I would, and decided to double down on this degree that had yet to earn me a job, and went back for my, and I had started in that period, I had started to look at museum jobs because I was like, that would be a really cool thing. But realized all these job listings I'm seeing require a master's. So I'm going to have to go back at some point. So, then eventually saved up some money and took the leap into a MA program.
Gotcha. Yeah. And you know, as well as I do, and anyone who works in a museum will tell you, we sure as hell don't do it for the money.
Yeah. And to be fair, there are eventually some decent paying jobs in the field, you know, once you get up to admin level stuff, but that can often take decades to get there. I don't actually think I'd want to be a museum administrator. I like the content too much. I don't want to get removed from that. And, you know, and that's like the top of the field eventually. Whereas a lot of, you know, guys I knew in college, some of my friends that were engineering degrees or something, they're getting hired right out the door for essentially more than where I got to now after years in this field. So.
Yeah, I understand. And, you know, and like you said, talking about wanting to avoid the administrative stuff, that's you and I have a mutual colleague who just retired from the working as a curator for 35 years. And he had the opportunity to be the director a handful of different times. And so he's like, I don't want to get bogged down in the bureaucracy. Like, I like being with the collection. I don't want to. I'll let someone else worry about the paperwork. I want to play with the stuff.
I mean, it's hard enough as is, like right now, even at a curator. I mean, really, we've both worked at sort of the entry level jobs in museums. And even then, it can be tough to get like really good time with the collection. And it only gets harder the further up the ladder you get.
Definitely. So when you went to the Fraser, what were you doing there?
So by that point, I was accepted into University of Louisville's MA program. And one of their public history requirements was that you had an internship. And I had had friends that lived in Louisville before. So that was kind of why it was on my list of places to go. And just even before I had applied, I had gone down there to visit them. And we hung out for the weekend. And we were like, hey, there's a museum downtown. Let's go. So we went and got to see the museum. I was like, wow, this is really cool. They had the Owsley Fraser collection there, and his really cool firearms collection.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is really awesome. Really enjoy the museum. And so when it came around to, I didn't have to get an internship in town. And I started sort of mid-year. I started in a spring semester instead of a fall semester. So everybody had already like gotten posted to internships in town. It was going to be waiting a while. So I ended up just, I talked to one of my advisors, and instead of waiting around for a paid internship or something to get posted, we just started like emailing the people that he knew there to see if I could get one. Mm-hmm. And they took me on as an unpaid intern. And then I clung on to that for all the hours I needed for the program. And then asked them if I could stay on after that to keep volunteering for a little bit. And eventually that turned into part-time and then full-time work there. So that was very much, it sort of spawned out of, I know they have a gun collection that's pretty cool. I know I need an internship. Let's start there and see what that brings.
Gotcha. So when you were there, the firearms were still a big part of the focus of that collection then.
Yeah. So I was there, if for those listeners that have visited in recent years, that's, they've removed a lot of them from display. I saw sort of the beginnings of that. I was a collections person, so don't yell at me. I was a barely full-time collections person. It was, you know, that was Mr. Frazier's vision for it, was that he was a very wealthy guy. In fact, if you drive around Louisville, you'll see all kinds of Frazier this and that. And it's because he gave a ton of money back to the community. but his passion was, you know, collecting firearms and knives and that kind of thing. And he's like, I want to make this into a museum. And he had the resources to do it, as you sometimes hear about in this world. And made it happen. And in some ways he was actually, you know, I saw a few people go through that museum and they sort of wanted to dismiss it as like, oh, it's just another, you know, old rich white guy collector. But there were some really innovative things about the firearms display in that museum. Mm-hmm. At least I think so.
What's your personal opinion on their change in their interpretation and moving away from Mr. Frazier's vision to what the museum is now?
I understand it to an extent. You know, everybody in the museum world is trying to, for good or worse, they're often trying to chase sort of what is relevant or what they think is relevant to a local audience. Mm-hmm. Of course, in Kentucky, they're on Whiskey Row. So doing a lot of that history, distilling history, certainly really interesting and can draw a lot. They did really show, I mean, because it was a new museum in a little bit of an awkward location, there's a bigger draw in the Slugger Museum across the street. Mm-hmm. They always struggled to find their footing in terms of what they were doing, I think. And it's sort of like they wanted to sit on, they wanted to be an arms museum and a regional museum, and they couldn't really do both anymore. And they landed on the side of being a regional museum. I think they had a really good thing going. And if they put some resources into the arms museum side of things, they could be a preeminent one. It's an awesome location. I think, you know, there is a bit of an awkwardness to it, but it's an awesome location. It's a really cool old building, which I know a lot of us that worked in museums have had to deal with old buildings and they're a giant headache. But environmentally, it was just a cool place to go see an exhibit. Sure. I guess I'm disappointed. I like guns, so it's disappointing to see it go away. But I try to be empathetic to their reasoning, you know, without going in like too much and burning too many bridges. There's definitely some mismanagement that went on, in my opinion. And then some directors that came in and didn't really share Frazier's original vision and... Mm-hmm. You know, his was very much about, we want to display these arms because they're important to all of us, whether you're that interested in firearms or not, they've impacted history. So let's learn about them. Right. And they had, like I said, a lot of people I think would criticize it, but you know, if you think about the museums that were around, in the early 2000s when it was designed, it was very contextual for its day compared to other firearms museums.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so then let's talk about other firearms museums, particularly the one you're at. And we had briefly touched on, you talked about, you know, it was disappointing seeing all the guns going away at the Frazier. And you guys just finished up a multi-year, multi-million dollar renovation of the Cody Firearms Museum. And that has led to a brand new form of interpretation of your collection. And a few years back, you guys hosted an Arsenals of History symposium. The first year, the term Gunquarium came up. It was just big glass cases filled with guns and, you know, basically devoid of context. And unfortunately, it's like that at a lot of museums, but you guys did an amazing remodel job. And there is now context to everything in that museum. It's incredibly well done. For people listening, if you've been years ago and you haven't been recently, you need to go and see this remodel. But I'm curious, what went into all of the thought and the planning to take it from a gunquarium that it had been for decades at that point? You know, what were the processes or the challenges that you faced in really and quite literally bringing that museum into the 21st century?
I mean, first of all, thank you for the compliments about the museum. I really do appreciate that. It's
well deserved.
Well, thank you. It was really a challenge. I mean, like I said, up until relatively recently, arms and armor displays were typically like a lot of stuff in a case. And, you know, we're a little bit hard on our own field. I think museums in general had tended to be that way for a while. The push for more context is a recent trend among all types of museums. Mm-hmm. I think not just necessarily arms museums. We might have been a little bit slower than everybody to change that or make an effort to change that. But it's really tough to balance because the old CFM, there was context in there, but it was buried pretty deep and it wasn't great. Like in a case of 40 guns, there might be like 100-word panel tucked on the sidewall. Like, I mean, it was limited.
Right.
But for a while that was what, you know, people seemed to want. It was received well when it opened back in the 90s. People like seeing a lot of guns on display. We were known for that. And, it very much fit that model of we're just going to shove a lot of guns in your face and like you get to, I hope you know something about them.
Right. And that's key. Know something about them because like you said, the context was implied and if you're a gun guy and you know what you're looking at, you understand why things are laid out the way they are in a given case. But if you're not a gun person you get lost in the minutia and overwhelmed by the tremendous amount of guns.
Yeah. And I mean, it's being a little bit mean. There was more to it than that, but it really much, it assumed a level of knowledge that most of our visitors didn't have. The museum was made for an enthusiast level audience.
Right.
And I think people assumed, well, if we're going to build a firearms museum, that's who's going to come to see it, is people that like firearms. And that's true. But there's also, because of our location in particular, we have audience that comes from all over the world. They're going to Yellowstone or coming out of Yellowstone. They see a museum. They're on vacation. Let's stop for a day, an afternoon, or whatever.
Right.
And let's go. And for those people, it became, all right, I can see why a gun. I mean, there are actual like TripAdvisor, old TripAdvisor reviews of this place. Like, if you're a gun enthusiast, yeah, but the family and I kept going. And that's not what we wanted.
Sure. Well, and so you guys you have four other museums in your complex too. So that's, you have to be cognizant of the people who get drug in because one family member wants to see the natural history stuff, but then how do you also keep that interest to the people who may wander over to the guns?
And that was something, you know, as we thought about what we wanted the renovation to be is, you know, we want the aficionados to be able to come and see something amazing, whether it's a one-off from Winchester, as something that is only in our collection, whatever that might be, or just to see all the sit model 1876s that they can at once. there's merit in that too.
Yep.
So, but we also recognize this might be somebody's first, only occasional chance. They might be here for entirely different reasons. And it's not that we wanted to like dumb down the content to necessarily, but we wanted to make it engaging with them. I don't want them to come and visit, you know, I really love the art museum. I really love Buffalo Bill. I skip firearms. Like, you know, that's not what we want either. So
yeah,
it was very much a balancing act between those two things and thinking about where do you even start with like getting somebody up to speed to appreciate, oh yeah, this is a Winchester rifle that belonged to Winchester himself. That's really cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So it takes some, oh, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it takes some building blocks to sort of get to that level. You can't appreciate that this is Oliver Winchester's rifle unless you have some understanding of like where he fits into the picture of firearms history.
Right. Yeah. If you don't know who Oliver Winchester is, it does you no good. It's like saying, hey, this was Henry Ford's personal Model T. Okay. Well, who was Henry Ford?
Right.
If you don't know, then it becomes irrelevant. So, yeah. Now you had touched on, talking about, you know, items in the collection that are one-off that you will only see in your museum. And a lot of that comes from the fact that the roots of your museum are in the Winchester factory collection. So talk a little bit about how the Winchester factory collection fits into your museum and how it came to be what we know now as the CFM.
Yeah, and I will do a quick plug that this is actually, as far as we can date it, this is the 150th anniversary of the collection. So we have a letter from Winchester, and he's talking about getting a gun for his collection in 1871. Okay. So 2021 marks the 150 years since that letter. Presumably, if he's talking about his collection, it actually is a little bit older, but we can't precisely date it.
Right.
But yeah, it seems that Winchester himself had some interest. You know, sometimes he's portrayed as a guy that's not super interested in the products he was making. He was just there for the business side of it. Mm-hmm. I don't buy that myself. And certainly that letter and some others indicate that he did have an interest in the guns they had made, where the roots of the company. So it appears that he collected not just what they were making for reference purposes, but he at least wanted to collect some for kind of a document of the company's own history and firearms history. And of course, as the company grew, they bought, you know, shortly after it became the Winchester Company, they were buying up Spencer. So then they got a bunch of that stuff in. So then along the very quickly, just the business of making firearms and being a major firearms manufacturer in that time period, they started acquiring. And so by the early 1900s, they had established essentially what was their working reference collection. Here's what we've made. Here's what we've patented. Here's an idea that somebody on the shop floor had. We'll tuck this away in case we need it later. Here's what our competitor's making. All that sort of stuff starts to coalesce into this really substantial firearms collection. And then of course, as their international sales grow and grow and grow, occasionally an international salesman will send something back. That's actually probably how we have the oldest gun in our collection, is a 4-barrel hand cannon. And an old museum inventory says that a salesman bought it in China. In like the late 20s, I think. So there's this variety of sources, and a couple employees along the way sort of take interest in it, but it never really turns into anything substantial until after World War II. They actually get a curator for the collection in Tom Hall, and decide that they're going to open a public museum for it. And in between when they hired Hall in the 40s, I believe, maybe early 50s. And then they start working towards a museum. And then, of course, they also buy the Edwin Pugsley collection. And Edwin Pugsley, for the listeners, was a long, long time Winchester engineer. The family, the descendants deny it, but he was very good friends with the guy that created the Adams family. And of course, Pugsley Adams was always tinkering with some old weapon or something.
Right.
So it's often been alleged that he was the inspiration for that character. The family, from what I understand, the family denies it, but I think it's true. But anyways, he was a longtime Winchester engineer, eventually vice president of the company. And he had collected guns himself since he was like a teenager. He sells the bulk of his collection to Winchester. They put all that into the Winchester Gun Museum, which opened in New Haven in 59. I think it didn't quite do it. I can't, trying to read between the lines and some of the old documents, I think they expected a pretty big public response to it, and it was not that forthcoming. Eventually, after 10 or 15 years, they started to shop around for a new home for the collection and eventually settled on Cody, Wyoming. So it moved out here in the 70s for the right before the bicentennial, and then went on display for until 91 as the Winchester Arms Museum. A lot of folks still know us as that, although not quite as many as when I first started here. And then we opened as the Cody Firearms Museum in 91, the version we had just been talking about. Sorry, that was the long answer, I guess.
No, nothing wrong with that. That's and really, you know, we're museum guys and we're history guys. That is the short answer.
Yeah, it could have been way worse.
Right. I know as well as you do, you know, that we could go on and on just talking the history of how the collection came to be. How many pieces are in the collection?
So there's about 27,000 cataloged items in the collection. Of course, I don't always broadcast this one, but we don't know if there's actually 27,000 things in the collection. Cause once you get to a certain number, as you well understand, you know, sometimes a box of ammunition got cataloged as one thing. Right. Sometimes it got cataloged as the box and 50 pieces of ammunition.
Yes.
So how do you go there? And of course, even in the best of times, museums are always trying to make sure they have everything. We have, you know, we keep track of the guns very well, but the wrench that was in the factory in 1880, yeah, it's cool. There's a pile of them. There might be 10, there might be 12. We're not totally sure. And it sounds, I'm sure your listeners are like shaking your head. Oh, these guys don't even know what they're doing. But trust me, that's the way the museum world works.
It is. Talk to any museum professional, and if you ask them very specific nitty gritty stuff about the collection, you will often get a lot of people kind of shaking their heads or shrugging their shoulders, because it's documentation standards today are not the documentation standards of decades before. Things get lost in the shuffle, and specifically with your collection, it literally moved halfway across the country too. Right. So, it's a lot to keep track of, but next time I'm there, I'm going to count the wrenches and we'll find out if there's 10 or 12.
10 or 12 somewhere.
Not
somewhere
11, around. But 10 Not 11. Or 12. Yeah.
11 is right out.
Yes. So do you have a favorite item in the collection? A personal favorite?
I try to vary this answer from time to time, but it's got to be the Burton. The Burton machine rifle is my favorite. It ticks a lot of boxes. And as you know, when you're researching for different projects, like you get really into like one specific topic, and for a while, like that'll be your favorite thing. Yeah, and that's part of what I love about the job, right? And it's like what we all love is you get to learn a lot and broaden your knowledge. But I keep coming back to the Burton machine rifle is a favorite.
It is a favorite. And it's, I know it's a hard gun to kind of explain because it's a little shrouded in mystery, but for those who may not have heard of it, can you give us the Reader's Digest of the Burton machine gun?
Yeah, I'll do my best museum short answer.
give us the label answer, right?
Yeah, the label. Burton Machine Rifle, Winchester Repeating Arms Company, 1916 or 17. And that's the label. Like, what else do we know?
Right.
So yeah, it's a rifle that we think was made by Frank Burton. At least really the closest we come to a primary source on it is the old Winchester Museum inventory. Which, without getting into the details of it, some of those entries were probably written by Burton himself. So it's potential that it was, him. But it's just recorded there as F.F. Burton machine rifle, 1917, tested in front of the army, put away. And that's it. Like that is the entry in their old inventory.
Right.
It's a select fire intermediate cartridge firearm. It's got a really distinctive a twin top feed magazine to it. Well, there's two magazines really. And it's, as far as we can tell, it's a blowback. It's not a, it's sort of, I think it's based somewhat on the Winchester self-loader series, but the breech plug that holds everything together is locked up tight. We've tried to disassemble it, but it doesn't come apart. So we can't see the bolt for sure. And yeah, with, it's this bizarre looking thing that barely fits the time period. There was an article a number of years ago that alleged an interview with the curator, you know, said it was for anti-balloon purposes. As best I can tell, that article, the author was remembering his interview with Tom Hall, because he said he talked to Tom Hall. But when he wrote that article, Tom Hall had been dead for a while. So it begs the question, like, what are you remembering to write this article?
Yeah.
And then, of course, it shows up. It becomes immensely popular because it shows up in Battlefield. And now I have like teenagers like on the daily asking me, where's the Burton? You know, the super obscure one-off Winchester prototype that was essentially unknown for 100 years. Shows up in, Ian does a video on it, shows up in a video game, and now it's actually pretty well known. So
yeah, and video games have been key, and I saw a lot of that, as I'm sure you did, you know, going through the galleries and younger folks asking about this gun or that gun, and one of the common themes is that it's a video game. You know, for a long time, it was, the guns were all related to Call of Duty, you know, and then it was Battlefield and this and that. And I think that's such a really cool thing, because you've got individuals who may not necessarily be gun folks, but they're being exposed to all this really interesting firearms history through the video games. And then they have the opportunity to come and actually see the real thing. And that's, you know, for so many people, you know, they're never going to see that real thing outside of a museum. So for them to have that connection, I love it. I know there's a lot of people who poo-poo on video games and stuff, but I think it's been a huge boom, particularly to firearms museums, because it's helped explode the popularity of the content in the museums.
Yeah, I have to agree. When I was growing up, I definitely heard like those guys, you know, people complain about, oh, you know, he didn't reload in that, you know, he just fired 20 rounds out of a 15 round magazine or whatever. Right. And I get it. Like, it is frustrating when the what should be relatively easy details are incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think popular culture is getting much, much, much better. Video games, especially, even more so than movies, are getting much, much more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
At least in terms of the details, you know, it's still nothing like actually firing a real firearm. But in terms of right. like the way things work and move, they're getting much better. But I always compare it to the Western. You know, Colts yeah. and Winchesters owe a lot of their collectability to, you know, the Jimmy Stewarts of the world and to the Western movie genre.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think video games are having, almost in real time right now, having that same effect on maybe not Colts and Winchesters, but on firearms in general.
Sure. No, you're absolutely right. And that's, and a lot of that with what folks are collecting, especially the younger folks, and it comes back to money. And the guys that are collecting the Winchesters and the Colts, you know, they grew up in the John Wayne era. And so now they are retired, they have disposable income, and they can drive those prices crazy on the Colts and Winchesters. Mm-hmm. And it's not attainable for guys our age. And, you know, but if you want to go collect Cold War era guns or something, you know, that those are relatively much more inexpensive than the Colts and Winchesters for now. Anyway,
for now
creeping up there too.
And I think some people wouldn't call what I'm about to say collecting, but I promise both you and I know, like, probably within not even having to think about it, like, we know people that own a Beretta 92 because it was in Die Hard.
Oh yeah. Like,
Beretta 92s, nobody would call that collecting per se right now. But the number of people that own one because of that movie, or an MP5 clone because of that movie, is, I mean, you see it all the time. I see it on social media. It shows up. I know people that have done it. So
sure.
Some people wouldn't call that collecting per se, but they're attainable. They're in popular mindset. And, then from there, you know, who's to say, you know what, I got these two, I also really like this movie. It's a cool movie gun. I'm going to add that one. And now you got three guns in, and I think that's a movie gun collection.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it was the same way 18 years before with Dirty Harry. You know, when Dirty Harry came out, the Smith & Wesson Model 29 was just another 44 Magnum revolver. And then that movie came out and everyone had to have one, and Smith couldn't keep up with production for years. Mm-hmm. And if it hadn't been for Clint Eastwood, you know, that gun would have never saw the resurgence that it did. So, no, I think you're absolutely right. There are plenty of people that buy stuff just because they've seen them in movies. And I think that's definitely a collection, no doubt about it. So now, what would you say is the hardest part about working specifically in a firearms focused museum?
Oh, that's a good question. When you tailor, there's the general stuff that comes with museum life, funding, you know, sort of a bureaucratic overlay on any of them. But for firearms specifically, I think it's the field as a whole doesn't know what to do with us. I would put that as my, if I think about what is a challenge for me in a firearms museum, it's that the field doesn't know how to handle us. And I say that because there are actually lots of resources out there. You know, there's grant money, there's conferences, there's all sorts of things to draw on for topics that you might need help with. But you take your firearms proposal to a museum conference and you'll get laughed out of the building. Like, some of it is, you know, I think hostility, because museum people tend to not be gun people.
Right.
Some of it, I think, is just history museums in general are kind of the museum, like the meta level museum field is dominated by art museums, not history museums.
Right.
And then within that subset, like museums that are like technology focused, like car museums, gun museums, that kind of thing, and military museums are their own sort of little niche within history. So yeah, I'd say that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would totally agree. And talking about the conferences and stuff, a few years ago now, I submitted a proposal to the Virginia Association of Museums on just a very basic, you know, identification and safety. You know, this is a bolt action, this is a semi-auto, this is how you can check to see if things are loaded, here's how you care for them, you know, just very, very basic stuff like that. And you know, and they came back and they're like, oh, we really like the concept, but you know, like, but some people are leery that you're using the word firearms in the title of your presentation. And I'm like, well, yeah, it's a presentation about firearms. Like, what, you know? So it was really, really hinky. You know, we had a hard time with that, but thankfully, that association's director was totally on board with wanting to do that. And it actually made it through. And that particular year was their 50th year of having conferences. And they told me it was the very first time they had ever had a presentation related to firearms. And they weren't sure how it was going to go over. And not to pat myself on the back, but Danny, they told me it was the most successful seminar that year. It was standing room only. And there were people in there that, you know, their museums didn't even have guns in them, but they wanted to come to that session. So that was really heartening for me, not only as a presenter to be in a room that, you know, that is bursting to capacity, but that there was so much interest in a field that generally is uninterested in what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And I mean, that's an awesome outcome for that. And I've had not quite to that extent, but I would similar, you know, I've done some of the local presentations on firearms. And what's crazy to me is I kind of like two follow-ups, I guess. The first one is it's crazy to me because so many museums, you know, there are museums that don't really, but so many museums do have firearms of some kind in the collection in the US, especially local history museums. You know, that's where the local veteran that's living somewhere tends to call up his local museum first to leave his World War II gun or whatever. So there's like a need for this knowledge to get out there, but then the field sort of at that discourse level is not super enthusiastic about it. But then it gets on this thing where it's like at a like staff, as you saw in your program, the staff that work at all these institutions, they want to go learn this stuff, right? their admins and the people running the conferences are all sort of, I don't know about that.
Right.
And I see that reflected in the field too, because how many times have you read like an article about museums or like a museum paper? And it's just like, some days I get this overwhelming impression that there's a segment of museums as at large that have almost no interest in what visitors want to see.
Oh, like, yes.
It's so bizarre to me. And that's something I like about the Firearms Museum is that, you know, we got to do something that really focused on what we hoped visitors would want to see. And we tried to really think about that. So,
right.
Again, not to pat myself on the back, but it was cool to be a part of a team that had that like mindset.
Yeah.
At the same time, I've just seen it. It's like a good example is like how the field treats military museums. Military museums are super popular. People like going to them. They have cool events and
yep.
families go out and they eat some hardtack and, you know, do whatever. And they're really, really popular. But if anything is like a redheaded stepchild, like firearms museums are in the field, it's military museums. They're sort of like the highbrow art world doesn't like it.
Right. And it's a shame because they, you know, like you said, they've got all the public programs and like you said, you know, they'll go out and eat hardtack and the kids will put on, you know, the reproduction wool jackets and stuff. And they have a hands-on tangible experience in a museum that they won't have in any other museum. They certainly won't have it in an art museum, you know, no touchy. But military history museums usually always have some kind of hands-on aspect to it. And that's so very important. And you guys did a great job in the redesign that there's actually a lot of hands-on stuff in your museum as well. And I think that is fantastic. As much as I like gunquariums and looking at tons and tons of guns, having those tangible aspects of it really take it to a new level, as you know, you guys did a great job incorporating that stuff in there, because they're not going to get that anywhere else. So.
Yeah. The hands-on thing, it's not necessarily that I want, like we have a handgun simulator. It's not necessarily that I want people to become like a proficient handgun shooter at the museum.
Right.
But it's all about making their experience here really valuable. You know, I want people to have a good memory here, some valuable experience. You know, one of my favorite things about the job, short of that I've gotten to hold the Burton machine rifle, is like when you go up, it's really rewarding to see like a family like talking with each other because they're interacting with an exhibit. To me, that's, you know, maybe they'll learn something about history, but there's a not purely historical side to it too. And I don't know, I have some wonderful colleagues in the art side of the field, but man, it just seems like as a whole, there's sometimes people lose sight of that. And I don't know why it is, but it's there.
Yeah. No, and I think part of it is because museum folks across the board are incredibly passionate about whatever aspect of a museum they work in, and you almost see it as an extension of yourself and as an extension of your own personal collection. In a way, you know, you're the caretaker of it, you know, because there's stuff in the museum collections that you'll never be able to afford, you know. But if you work in an art museum that has a Van Gogh, you know, that you'll hear them, well, my Van Gogh is such and such, you know, and, you know, so, and I know we do it too in the gun museums. You'd be like, Danny, what's your 1876 like that has the such and such, you know, and we don't refer, you know, what's the CFMs? No, it's, hey, what's Danny's like, you know, and we tend to view them that way. And I think sometimes, it is easy to lose sight of what's actually important, and it's not us, it's the visitor. Cause if you don't get the feet through the door, then you don't have the museum. So,
right. I mean, ultimately, you know, not to like be too high-minded here myself, but it is about like my philosophy on museums is that in a digital age, when you can go on and you can see any, you know, you can find a YouTube video on virtually any gun that's ever been made. There are exceptions, of course, but the content is out there. You could learn a lot of what you learn here somewhere else.
Sure.
But there is value in being in front of the physical thing. And like, that's why museums are still relevant to me. And whether that's a firearm or a jacket from the 1800s or whatever it might be, or a painting, it's cool to see people engage with the thing that was there. And you're totally right. Like, I call this my collection all the time. Like, I have such a tiny part in this collection, like, but it's easy to fall into that. And And then I'll be mad at somebody else, you know, I'll name like Alex or, you know, somebody else like Jonathan over Royal Armies. I'll be like, oh, they got one of these. I wish we had that. You know, it's like a dig at them personally, even though they're super cool guys, but it's like jealousy of their museum collection, not them.
And then they'll tease back. Cause I know I've done it with Jonathan. You'd be like, he's like, yep, you're right. I've got one and you don't.
there's totally a pride thing in that. Like, I'll pick out a good one. So we have, as far as I know, the most Winchester revolvers of anywhere. There's a few floating in private hands.
Yeah.
We might have the only ones in museums. I'm not sure. So like when that comes up, like, I'm like, yeah, this, I'm pretty cool. Cause we have all these and it's, I didn't collect them. I didn't make them. They just happened to be here when I got here.
Right. Yep. But you know what? For the time being, they are yours, you know, and that's just how it works.
Right.
So as we wrap up, I have one big question for you. If you could meet any firearms designer, living or dead, who would it be and why?
That's a great question. Man, it's tough to pick. There's a couple choices for me. It boils, you know, you could pick JMB or, you know, Mauser or Luger or some of those guys, and there's certainly a lot to talk there. And there's a lot of people that are on like my short list, mm-hmm. but when it boils down to like first choice, it's between TC Johnson, Frank Burton, and Edwin Pugsley.
Okay.
Burton is on the list because I want to ask him directly, what happened? Why didn't you write this down? Like, what's going on with this thing? TC Johnson, I have similar questions for, but if I get to talk with him, I get to answer maybe a broader range because he was at the company a little bit longer. So he might have I can ask him about that. And then maybe I can ask him about something else over here. And Pugsley's sort of a similar reason. Like, there's no one thing I want to ask Pugsley about, but he was at the company, at the Winchester company, in a time span that like he could answer so many questions that come up. Cause I mean, you know, when you start looking into primary sources, you hope to get an answer, but all you often walk away with is more questions.
Yeah.
Or an answer to a question you weren't asking. And you're like, well, great. Now I got to go learn about this.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody like that could fill in the gaps. Burton's on there because that one's burning me up. And because Burton has a cool family story. So I could probably ask him about his dad.
Yeah. James Henry.
For the listeners, is a super important but obscure figure for Civil War firearms. So
exactly. Yep. And for people who are tuning into this on YouTube, if you've seen some of the content on my channel, you will have actually seen a presentation I did on James Henry Burton, because he is a fascinating guy and led an amazing life in the arms industry, and his kids did as well. And so if you haven't seen that video, a little personal plug, go check that one out, because James Henry Burton is fascinating. And of course his son wouldn't be nearly as cool if he hadn't gotten some of his stuff from his dad. Right. So,
right. And by like, you know, sheer coincidence of history, I guess, we actually ended up with a few of James Henry's, post-war rifles in our collection. So
really,
it's a weird connection that, Frank and I think is actually his brother both worked for Winchester for a while.
Mm-hmm.
His brother would go on to work for, this is like totally going down a rabbit hole, but his brother would go on to work for the Moeller Pipe Organ Company in Hagerstown.
Oh, okay.
Which is a weird connection, but it's there. Then years later I'm working, you know, with the firearms collection studying this Frank guy, and lo and behold, I'm like, wait, there's this other gun named Burton in the collection. That doesn't look like a early assault rifle. Like, what is this thing? And they're probably, you know, have that family connection, even though those guns didn't actually, those came from a donor in recent years, not part of the Winchester collection.
Gotcha. Yeah. And there is, and again, going down the rabbit hole with the Burtons, but there is a small it's a house museum slash battlefield museum in the northern part of the Shenandoah Valley. And it was actually one of the homes that Burton lived in near the end of his life. And one of the things that they got donated to them in recent years through the family was his fold down desk and chair, as well as traveling trunks that have his name stenciled on the side of them. And the family documentation with that is that that's the desk and those are the trunks that were used when he took the job at Enfield in England. And that's what he moved the family over in. So that was really cool. They actually, I'll be a bad museum person, slap myself on the wrist, but they let me sit in the chair at the desk. And so I have a really cool picture of myself in Burton's desk, at that's his awesome. Desk. Yeah, it's very, very cool. It hadn't been accessioned into the collection yet. So it
it's technically not an artifact, wasn't a museum. Succession.
Exactly. There was no number on it, so I'm good to go. But
it's the same thing I tell myself because I stick my hand in virtually every Civil War cannon I come across. Like first thing I touch it. Like just
there you go.
What happens? Yep.
That's right. Awesome. Well, Danny, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come onto the show. For folks who are interested in learning more about the museum, where can they find you guys, Danny?
Yep, you can go to centerofthewest.org and we have a museum page and you can find out about all five museums here at the center. You can find the podcast, although enter at your own risk. It's Ashley and I ranting and raving about who knows what. at History Unloaded on most of your major podcast platforms, or of course we have our social channels, Instagram and Facebook at Cody Firearms Museum.
Awesome. Well, once again, Danny Michael, the curator at the Cody Firearms Museum, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.